Hello and welcome to the American Magazine podcast for the week of November 28th. And we're very pleased to have joining us today Father John Andres from the Jesuit School of Theology of Santa Clara University at Berkeley and Sister Julia Prince, also of the school. Perhaps you could both tell us a little bit more about yourselves. First, Sister Julia.
Yes, I'm Sister Julia Prince, and I'm actually a sister of the Verbum Dei Missionary Fraternity. That's a very young congregation that was founded during Vatican II, and that's our name, Verbum Dei, and it was founded parallel to the Constitution, Dei Verbum. And that's what we're doing, unfolding the Word of God, and that's what I'm doing at the Jesuit School of Theology at Berkeley. I'm lecturing there on hermeneutics, and especially biblical hermeneutics and Christian spirituality. And I was invited to join two colleagues of mine under Lily Grant to go actually to different countries in Asia to look at the formation of women religious and to see how we can respond at the Jesuit school and actually also in my own congregation, which has a formation center on the West Coast and the Pacific Rim, to the needs and the expectations of sisters who are coming over the Pacific Ocean to get educated or to become spiritual directors, novice master or mistresses, better to say, for their own congregation. And so to learn from them, to see how they do their own theology, formation, spirituality, and to also learn from their needs and challenges.
Well, Father John, maybe you can just let us know why you're here in New York. You folks are from the West Coast, but part of it is to introduce this program to some people here on the East Coast.
Thank you. I'm Father John Andres. I've been teaching at the Jesuit School of Theology since 1982. I teach Old Testament studies and also some courses in biblical spirituality. One of the reasons that the major reason we came here is because our school does a program called Theology in the City. In a few select cities each year, and each year here in New York, where we invite friends and benefactors and alums to come and hear a talk that we hope is of some interest to them by members of the faculty. So we were invited, as Sister Julia mentioned, to come and speak about this journey, this pilgrimage we took that we called Bare Feet in Theology.
So this was a delegation of faculty from Santa Clara, the Jesuit School of Theology of Santa Clara University at Berkeley. I got the whole title in there. It's very interesting. That's an interesting point, Sister Julie, that you have a lot of people coming from these countries to train at your school.
Yes, I mean the thing is that it has been an increase, and I think Father John Andres can say more to that. An increase in definitely in the Jesuits from the Pacific Rim coming to the school, and through that we definitely found out that there is more and more need also for women and religious women to be able to get a theological education, because they are in many of those countries we visited, and we visited Philippines, Japan, Vietnam, Hong Kong to have a look into China and India. And in especially the countries Vietnam, India, and China, we the people shared with us their need to have women theologically trained, because they are the pillars of the new church that is arising. Now, for example, in India, we are talking more about northern India. Southern India, of course, has a very long established church. But especially in the northern part of India, there's very young dioceses where really the religious women are the pillars of it. And so it's practically twofold. One is that our own congregation has more vocations from those countries. We are not in those countries, but people who find out and oversee studies of our, you know, about our community. And so they are coming to our community to be trained in San Francisco. And in Berkeley, we have that situation with a Jesuit school where we had to think about how do we react to that need of religious women to study, because there is no community. There is, first, we need to look at program possibilities. We need to look at how to facilitate them housing, community life, ways of spiritual support, psychological accompaniment, and so on and so on.
So what did you learn from these women religious in these various countries? Maybe there are some examples you can share with us about, you know, what the work they're doing.
You know, I think one of the most important things we learned is that we would have never expected to really be challenged so profoundly in our own way of teaching, of seeing the diversity of what Asia really is about. You know, you talk easily about an Asian spirituality, an Asian theology, and first of all, to realize that there is no Asia besides in perhaps the economic and certain geographical ways of putting it, but that you really have to talk about the people in specific regions and have to say, okay, are we talking about somebody from India or from Vietnam? Are we talking about a woman born in China or born in Hong Kong or in Japan? So it's very specific. And I think perhaps, Father Dronis, you want to say something to that, but then I could say somehow also something about what it meant to me theologically to see the inculturation processes, these women religious have done in the different areas of their countries to bring, actually, I would say, faith not so much to the people, but from the people, to actually root the faith in what people's experience has been and what people's narratives are and what people's memory is and what people's experience is where they are. And from there to let be faith, Christian faith, be born. That's a very different understanding than saying, oh, I know what Christian faith is and I just go to the indigenous and the tribals in northern India and now they need to believe what I believe. To actually go there and to see, wow, what they build up from the narrative, from the rituals, from the understanding, the memory, the communion, the community of the people. And then from there to let be born the memory of Christ.
Well, from what you say, Sister Julia, maybe we can have Father John weigh in. It sounds to me like a very Jesuit way of doing things, kind of looking at the culture and learning from the culture.
Oh, I think it is very much. And one of the things that was really kind of exciting is so many of the contacts that we made were through Jesuit graduates of our school. And we went to them and told them what we were interested in, and they pointed out various congregations they thought we ought to visit. Some of them, our major contact in Vietnam was a sister who'd been a longtime friend of one of the Jesuits at our school. And a number of our Vietnamese Jesuits had gone to Vietnam to give retreats and to help with the training of the spiritual directors. So there's a way in which this Jesuit way of going about things, or Ignatian, I think, I'd rather say, has helped us and our students to build up a bigger network so that the graduates from our school really taught us what they learned from us and how it helps them not to propagate what they're doing in their home country, but to network and to find out what God is doing in the way that Sister Julia just mentioned.
Well, I have one example here you spoke about last night. It was in Manila. You met up with a sister, Cecilia, who's a Filipina sister. Maybe you could speak a little bit more about her specific story.
I'll start because she's an old friend because she studied with me and I worked with her on her D-Min thesis. Sister Cecilia is a religious of the Assumption. She had put in over 20 years working in Thailand with Buddhist-Christian dialogue and work in villages. Then she came to do more studies in Berkeley, got a degree with us, and really always enjoyed the biblical part of it the most, where she worked on wisdom literature. She went back, and then all of a sudden she was back to do a D-Min. But the amazing, so after doing all that kind of work, she's back in the Philippines working on the southern island of Mindanao, which, as most of us are aware, is a place of great poverty and also great struggle between Christians and Muslims. It's kind of the core area of Muslim rebellion. And she's doing base community-based village work there. And I'd like Julia to tell us a little bit about how she experienced that.
Well, I think the experience of Cecilia in Mindanao is so interesting for what we did in the whole pilgrimage, because she practically brings together children in their needs. She just, from a very war-torn zone, she just looks at the children as children of their culture and of their religions and of their differences, and brings them together in with lunch packages and having education programs and just sharing and letting them play together. And all the obstacles she encounters, the prejudices, the things she has to overcome in the church, in the society, to be able to do them, to just be able to bring children together. That is, I think that's such a typical way of how we saw that women religious all over in very different countries had their projects of changing societies from down under, from really the grassroots, from the networking, from the ways of how humanity really could overcome conflict and difference in peace. And I think it was very interesting what you were saying right now, both of you, that it is an Ignatian way of connecting to culture. It is, I think, just that it is so often forgotten that through listening to the other, you learn how to share and you learn how to be enriched and you learn about the how faith can actually change this world. But it's through listening to the other and to the other culture and taking it serious and not just packaging something I already know into just a new ribbon and then thinking the other is going to be happy with that, but actually to really listen where the other is.
One interesting thing here, Father John, is that you mentioned the relations with Muslims. We're just coming out of Assisi and the interreligious meetings there. What do the experiences of some of these women have to teach us about interreligious dialogue?
I think quite a bit, especially because in all these countries, except for the Philippines, and I would have to say the main North Island in the mm-hmm. Philippines, every place else, the Christians, the Catholics are really minority. And so they've really learned and been forced to learn how to get along and how to build some kind of bridges, some kind of shalom, so that they can be with their neighbors. In India, there are all kinds of shades of discrimination. Some of it's religious, and some of it is that there's a great difficulty of overcoming the caste system in India.
And that I think I find actually very interesting. I find much more than that the different religions were difficulties for the women religious. It was the social and the political and the economical oppression. So say, for example, the problem is not so much that other women are of other religions they are working together with, but that all of the women are experiencing the consequences, say, for example, in the Chinese context, of Confucianism and of certain oppressive straits of Confucianism towards women. They are experiencing the caste system, not so much as a religious expression, but as a very specific, in specific straits, against them as women. They are in Vietnam. They are experiencing the social, political consequences of oppression against women. So what we just experienced is an enormous solidarity between women, very often sparked by women religious, but in a certain sense also critical towards a social, political, and economical oppression and exploitation and injustices against women. So religion, as it was right now in the experience of Cecilia, was really not any kind of obstacle. It was practically much more, okay, how are we going to pull our children through? How are we going to get them a bike to go to school? And the women as much as the men, so that means the little boys as much as the girls. Where is the girl going to get her bike in India to ride to school from? And so these are the questions, and I think that makes them so incredibly creative. I think if one thing we realized over there is how creative and how joyful and how humorous and how just wanting to enjoy life and expand life to anybody everywhere.
I just thought of a very good example of this. When we went to visit Bodh Gaya, which is the place where Buddha experienced his enlightenment under the Bodha tree, we went first to meet the small Jesuit community that's resident there, and the priest that came out to meet us, dressed in an Indian fashion, he was kind of tired, and we asked why. He said, well, on that particular day every week, he goes and does non-formal education with about 25 or 30 women who are very poor and are trying to learn some English and learn
basic
some
skills.
Some mm-hmm. basic skills so they can engage in small business. So we asked him, oh, where was this? Right down the street? He said, oh, no, it's a two-hour walk each way.
Each direction.
Wow.
And I said, you do that twice a week? And he said, oh, yeah. And we kind of, I looked and he says, it's important for them. And that made a great impression on me.
Yeah. And then you remember the one of the local theologates up in Ranchi.
Yes.
All the women, you know, all the young women and everybody would know what was coming out of that theologate because they would do theology in the villages, in the rural areas, in really just wherever they could reach the poorest of the poor. It is very impressive, all the sacrifice they take on just to be really with the people where they are.
Very rich experiences you had, obviously, on this trip. Maybe we can pick out one more. I'm just looking here at some of the things you talked about last night, and one is that Sister Julia in Japan, some of the lessons that the church leaders there feel like the church could learn from the culture, including like the Japanese understanding of silence.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you could talk about that.
Yeah, it was very, very interesting. I think one of the things, actually, Archbishop Ikenaga in Osaka, we were talking with him, and he had quite a critical view on his own initial moment of becoming a Christian when he was a teenager. And then he said, I had a long journey to walk to actually understand who I was as a Christian being Japanese. And he said that one of the things he would like to see would be an incarnated theology, that we don't only practically import the church, but that we import the words, the sophia, the wisdom into the culture. And they said one of the things he really misses in the Catholic Church is a prayer that would be more appropriate to the Japanese culture, which is silent. And he says there is not one silence. For you Westerners, there is only one kind of silence. For us, there is a multitude of different silences. And we don't have prayers, and we don't have a prayer form in the Catholic Church to actually express those multitudes of silence. And I was very touched by that because I was thinking, well, what do Japanese background holding people in my own community or at education centers do with that experience? I mean, that they really need a prayer that is appropriate to the culture. And he said, well, because it's only in silence that you really experience the embrace of God. You're not going to make a Japanese understand atonement and sacrifice if you don't make them understand that in silence they are part of the body of Christ. They are part of a Christ that is including them, not excluding them. It is not, he's not actually scourging them, but he is embracing them. And so it was very interesting how he said we should look to music, art, architecture, literature, which has done a much, much greater job in Japan than theology, to take culture serious and include it practically in a Christian message.
Well, that's very interesting. I'm thinking of the Japanese writer who had the
Endo.
Endo, mm-hmm. His book is called Silence.
Yes, exactly. And he brought that up. He brought also up the great church, St. Ignatius Church in Tokyo, which has been an architecture that if you go into the church, the whole church is, it's round, it's embracing, it is moving, the forms is very different than rectangular and straight. And so in that sense, we can really learn from these aspects, art and music and literature.
Well, now, this was 2 years ago. You had this trip, and you spoke about it last night, so you're sharing your experiences with graduates and friends of the school. What else have you learned? What else have you brought back to the classroom out of this? And, you know, what are you looking to do going forward?
It's made a profound impact on me. I think the first thing I would say is it's really taught me to listen better to my students. I think I was starting to do that before I went because that's why I was interested in going to Asia. But I've been so interested in listening to Indian students that I've worked with and to Vietnamese students and then to some of the students from the Philippines and from Hong Kong. And as a matter of fact, I think this is something I got from my father, was to learn to ask more questions than to tell things, to tell stories. But it's helped me to listen more. I teach Old Testament, and now that we've seen some of the artistic representation of the creation mythos among the tribal people in India. I found some of it unbelievably similar to what we have in our biblical texts. And now, since that, when I teach that, I've had some Indians, Jesuits in the class, and they have very interesting angles to bring to the interpretation of some of these texts.
Yeah, I think what you're saying, no? I mean, on one hand, I think we went onto this pilgrimage because we wanted to listen. We wanted to really to more listen to them. But I think one of the things, theologically, I got really, reignited with, if you want to say it like that, in a much deeper sense, is to go back to the narrative. If you think that our dogma in the Roman Catholic Church, and I think in general in the Christian tradition, at the core has been always narrative and always was, I told you, I share with you, I share with you my life, I share with you my experience, I share with you the word of God, the Sophia of God, the Logos, the wisdom of God. It is relational, deeply relational, and this trip in a certain sense made us go back to those narratives, made us really aware enculturation is something about at the heart of the dogma is narrative, and listen to the narrative to be able to actually from there develop Christianity that is actually capable for future, and it is capable to create networks and social resistances and social alternatives and political visions that are based in the experience of people. And I actually have to say, if you see the political picture right now, very often what is taken from religion is exterior form or exterior rules, and it is not taking the experience of the people to actually develop political visions or political possibilities or even opportunities. And so I just think that really touched me deeply to rediscover in a certain sense what it means to incarnate, to inflesh, not to just in church, but to actually inflesh our faith, and to do that especially with women and solidarity with women.
One of the things that happened after this is that the two of us taught an advanced seminar on biblical hermeneutics and interpretation called Memoria Passionis, and Johann Baptist Metz's theology was a great lead for us. But I'm thinking back of the students in that class from Zambia, from Vietnam, from South Korea.
India,
Malaysia, and several other countries, Mexico. It was an amazing group of students, and I don't think we could have ever helped them to articulate issues that were important from their own experience and to interpret them theologically in terms of spirituality as well. I couldn't have done that without this trip. And so for me, the biggest outcome is I think we helped some of our students develop beyond our imagination.
And helped them even to, even the men in the class, they were suddenly looking at the oppression in their own countries and very often would do biblical hermeneutics from the perspective of women. And from the perspective of the oppression they had seen in their aunt, or the abuse they had witnessed in another woman in their family or in their surrounding, and suddenly it was a man in the class who would speak for the woman. And I think that is another thing we really realized on the trip. It didn't matter. It didn't matter if it was a Jesuit or a religious woman, but if they were ignited by faith, they were generally on the side of the oppressed, and they were on the side of the abused women.
Well, Sister Julia, Father John, thank you both for joining us, and have a safe trip back home.
Thank you very much.